Hezekiah, like a cage bird, Brother Tom.
We did the study a number of years ago, and I've come to the conclusion, as far as Old Testament characters, Hezekiah is one of my favorites. What Hezekiah did for the reform of Israel is what made him one of my favorite people in the Old Testament. And so I'd like to look at his life a little bit and see some of the things that maybe we can glean from his example and his life. The phrase "like a caged bird" comes from a six-sided clay tablet called the Taylor Cylinder. The cylinder is an archaeological artifact that was discovered in 1830 in the ruins of Sennacherib's palace in Nineveh, in the excavations there. And it's presently in the British Museum, although a couple of years ago I had the chance to see a replica of it in the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago. And I was surprised it's smaller than I would imagine. Looking at that picture, it looks pretty big, but it's only about 18 inches tall. It's fairly small, and it's just actually amazing how much writing they were able to get on that. It's one of the most perfect archaeological specimens of its kind ever found, and its historical significance is absolutely immense. It contains 487 lines of very legible cuneiform text. It records 8 military expeditions of Sennacherib, who was king of Assyria. And, of course, the most interesting one to us is when he came against Jerusalem and sieged it during the reign of Hezekiah. Let me read the lines 11 through 21 from the center column of that tablet. This is how Sennacherib recorded the events that are also recorded in the scripture. So we're going to compare the two. He says, "I fixed upon him and of Hezekiah, king of the Jews, who had not submitted to my yoke, 46 of his fenced cities, and the strongholds and the smaller cities which were round about them and which were without number, by the battering rams and by the attack of engines and by the assaults of foot soldiers. And I besieged. I captured 200,150 people, small and great, male and female, horses and mules and asses and camels and men, and sheep innumerable from their midst I brought out. And I reckoned them as spoil. Hezekiah himself, like a caged bird within Jerusalem, his royal city, I shut in." Now, the historical record indicates that Sennacherib really devastated the land of Israel. And much of what he wrote there is confirmed for us in the scriptures. In 2 Kings 18:13, it says that he came up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. And then in verse 17 of that chapter, we read of Sennacherib's siege of Jerusalem. But here's an interesting point about the clay cylinder and Sennacherib's account of the siege of Jerusalem. In the last line that we read, notice what Sennacherib said concerning Hezekiah and Jerusalem. He said that Hezekiah was like a caged bird within Jerusalem and that the city was shut in. And that was true. He had the city surrounded and caged in, but never does he say that he actually took the city. If you were not reading carefully, you would assume that Jerusalem fell just like all the other cities of Judah, but he never said that it did. When Sennacherib said that he had Hezekiah like a caged bird, he was saying that coming to Jerusalem, you've heard the phrase, it was like shooting fish in a barrel, right? You can't miss. They're right there. And so the implication is Jerusalem was no problem. It was just like all the other cities of Judah. But when you read the scriptural account, you see what a misleading statement that Sennacherib was trying to record for history and for his own posterity. In 2 Kings 19:35 through 37, we read what actually happened. It says, "That night, the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when men rose early in the morning, behold, all of them were dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived at Nineveh. It came about us, as he was worshiping in the house of Nishrath, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer killed him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat, and Esarhaddon, his son, became king in his place." Now the pages of history never mention again that Assyria was able to come up against Israel. And I think looking at this and looking at how Sennacherib ended his life, I think that his murder was really an indictment against his God, that even while praying in his temple, Sennacherib was not safe. While the contrast of Hezekiah is that he's surrounded by 185,000 soldiers who want him dead, and he is safe and secure because he prayed in the safety of God's temple. And the Syrians came to learn that this was not a God to be toyed with, that they could not contend with the God of Israel. And so the boasting words of Sennacherib's clay tablet were true. He did have Jerusalem shut in like, and Hezekiah cornered like a caged bird. But you can see what Sennacherib was after. He was after a recording history of himself being victorious in everything he did. And so he gives us a half a truth, a missing fact that we need to see the whole picture. And it's when we get the honest truth from the scriptures that we see, as Paul Harvey used to say, we see the rest of the story when we get the truth from the scriptures. We'll get back to this part of the story of Hezekiah and look at the siege of Jerusalem in more depth. But before we do that, I'd like to examine the atmosphere that surrounded Hezekiah as he was growing up. What made Hezekiah the man that he was? We cannot possibly appreciate what an amazing king he was until we understand what a negative influence that he had in his youth. Hezekiah's father was King Ahaz. In 2 Chronicles 28, 1 through 4, we're told that Ahaz had made graven images, had burned incense to Balaam, and in fact, he was the first king to offer up children in the fire as sacrifices to heathen God. This was Hezekiah's father. Because of the wickedness of Ahaz, Israel was constantly plagued by invasions and wars. In 2 Chronicles 28, 19, we're told that the effect that Ahaz had on Israel, it says, "For the Lord brought Judah low because of Ahaz, king of Israel, for he made Judah naked and transgressed sore against the Lord." Ahaz made Israel and Judah naked by stripping them of the true and legitimate worship of Jehovah. And the result was that Jehovah refused to protect them against their enemies. Now in the 29th chapter of 2 Chronicles comes his son Hezekiah. And in that context, we're told that he was 25 years old when he became king, that he reigned for 29 years, and that his mother's name was Abijah. And we're told that he did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that David his father had done. There are not many kings that can be said of. Hezekiah really was only one of three kings in all of Israel who had been pleasing to the Lord. The others were David and Josiah. But you know what? In a way, Hezekiah's case is more remarkable even than the other two, because his father was one of the most wicked kings that Israel had ever had. And in fact, Ahaz was so disesteemed that when he died, he wasn't even buried in the tomb of the kings. When Hezekiah began to reign, I love the first thing he did. He was like a man on a mission. His first priority as king was to make things right with God. And that's one of the things I love about him. He didn't say, "Oh, I got to do this first. I got to do that." His first priority was, we need to clean up our relationship with God. This promptness and focus on the Lord is what made him such a wonderful king for Israel. We'd like to go to 2 Chronicles 29 and begin reading at verse 3. It says, "He, in the first year of his reign, in the first month, opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. And he brought in the priests and the Levites and gathered them together into the east street and said unto them, 'Hear me, ye Levites, sanctify now yourselves and sanctify the house of the Lord God of your fathers and carry forth the filthiness out of this holy place. Now it is in my heart to make a covenant with the Lord God of Israel, that his fierce wrath may turn away from us. My sons, be not negligent, for the Lord hath chosen you to stand before him, and that you should minister unto him and burn incense.' And they gathered their brethren and sanctified themselves and came according to the commandment of the king by the words of the Lord to cleanse the house of the Lord." It's hard to believe that Hezekiah could be in this frame of mind to do these things given who his father was and the deplorable spiritual conditions that he was raised in. How could he be so different, so intent on doing the Lord's will when the examples around him growing up were just so bad? You know, they say that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. You've heard that expression. Well, here was an apple that wasn't even from the same tree as his father. Knowing the influence that our upbringing has, how we are our environment, we are who our parents make us in many cases, the answer has to be that not everything around him was evil. In fact, on reprint 3462, Brother Russell suggests that it's a little unusual for Hezekiah's mother's name to be mentioned in the introduction of Hezekiah's life, and that possibly this early mention of her suggests that it was her good influence that made Hezekiah the man that he was. And this is Brother Russell's conclusion. He says, what a lesson we have here respecting the power of a mother for good. She evidently exercised a molding, controlling influence in the formation of her son's character. The influence of a mother rightly exercised is very highly to be appreciated. So, those of you who are parents, you must know the importance of your influence on your children. You have a lot to do as to whether your child becomes Ahaz or Hezekiah, or the feminine version of those names. It's an interesting suggestion that in this account that maybe that the prophet Isaiah was actually brought in to be Hezekiah's tutor. And I think that's probably true, and it wouldn't be surprising if it's true, because he's the one who comes and gives the Lord's answers to Hezekiah later in our story, and he appears to be genuinely close to Hezekiah. They were friends. And so I think there's another lesson in that, that Hezekiah had such a special tutor as Isaiah. And I think that, again, for parents, to see the wisdom of having our children associate with brethren as often as possible, to take every opportunity to send our kids to seminars, to camps, to whatever activity involves the Lord's people, so that in a similar way our kids can be tutored by the brethren, that we don't have to be the only influence in our kids' lives, but put them in a spiritual environment so they can become children of faith. Now, if Hezekiah's mother did arrange for Isaiah to be her son's tutors, and it was one of the wisest decisions that she ever made, and it eventually came to benefit the entire nation of Israel. Well, Hezekiah's work continued. We're told that it took 16 days to get rid of all the filthiness in the temple that Ahaz had put there. This picture, maybe it's kind of hard to see. This is actually a woodcut from Henry VIII's Bible from the year 1538, and it depicts Hezekiah burning some of the idols that Ahaz had placed in the temple. We're going to go back to 2 Chronicles. This is starting at verse 20. It says, then Hezekiah the king rose early and gathered the rulers of the city and went up to the house of the Lord. And they brought 7 bullocks and 7 rams and 7 lambs and 7 he-goats for a sin offering for the kingdom and for the sanctuary and for Judah. And he commanded the priests, the sons of Aaron, to offer them on the altar of the Lord. And then in verses 22 through 24, the priests offered all these animal sacrifices. And at the end of verse 30, it says that they sang praises with gladness and they bowed their heads in worship. And then in verse 31, Hezekiah said, now that you have consecrated yourself to the Lord, come near and bring sacrifices and thank offerings to the house of the Lord. And the assembly brought sacrifices and thank offerings, and all those who were willing brought burnt offerings. And did they bring their offerings? My goodness, it says that they brought 70 bullocks, 100 rams, 200 lambs, 6,000 oxen, 3,000 sheep. In fact, they brought so many animals to be sacrificed that there weren't enough priests to do the work. And so the Levites were called in to help. What an incredible scene, especially considering where they were just a few months before this. What a reformation that he caused in Israel, all because one man wanted to reinstate the worship of Jehovah in Judah. Of course, he had to find cooperative hearts in the people. But brethren, here's an example of what good leadership can accomplish. And the lesson here is that the Lord can do wonderful things through those who willingly commit to the Lord's work, whatever that work might be at the time, because it's really the leadership that has a lot to do with where the brethren go even today. If the leadership is good and vital and dedicated and consecrated, the brethren will follow that lead. Well, in the next chapter, we're told that all this work in the temple happened around the time of the Passover. But it was all happening so quickly that the priests did not have enough time to make the proper preparations and to gather the people in time to observe the Passover at its normal time. And so after consulting with those who understood the law, it was determined that under these circumstances, it was allowable to observe the Passover on the following month. Once this was decided, Hezekiah sent out a decree, along with the Passover decree stating that it would be observed, when it would be observed. He also sent letters to the 10 tribe kingdoms of the north, inviting them to share in the Passover. You know that the 10 tribe kingdoms of the north were much deeper in their idolatry than Judah had been, although under Ahaz it had gotten pretty close. Many of the Israelites of the north had already been taken captive into Assyria. So the northern tribes were largely decimated by this time. Hezekiah's letter to the north, I thought, was just wonderful. It's given to us in 2 Chronicles 30, verses 6 through 9. And he basically counseled them to yield themselves to Jehovah so that God's wrath would turn away from them. And there was a mixed response to his letter. Reading from verse 10 of 2 Chronicles 30. It says, "So the post passed from city to city through the country of Ephraim and Manasseh, even unto Zebulun. But they laughed them to scorn and mocked them. Nevertheless, divers of Asher and Manasseh and of Zebulun humbled themselves and came to Jerusalem. And in Judah the hand of God was to give them one heart to do the commandment of the king and of the princes by the word of the Lord." Now, there were many, even though there was a mixed response, there were many who came from the north. Although they had not gone through the proper ritual cleansings, they partook of the Passover anyway. And under normal circumstances, that probably would have meant met with severe punishment. But we're told that Hezekiah prayed for them. This is what Hezekiah said. He said, "The good Lord pardon every one that prepareth his heart to seek God, the Lord God of his fathers, though he be not cleansed according to the purification of the sanctuary. And the Lord hearkened to Hezekiah and healed the people." So we see in Hezekiah a determination to reestablish the worship of God and, in fact, to bring all Israel back together. And again, one of the things that impressed me the most was his desire to help not just the tribe of Judah, but his brethren of the north. The context in history here is that some 250 years before Hezekiah, you remember there had been a bitter division between the 10 tribes of the north and the two tribes of Benjamin and Judah. And ever since that time, they operated as separate autonomous nations. And idolatry was really rampant in the north for a much longer time than in Judah. And their relationship had deteriorated so much so that during the reign of Hezekiah's father, Ahaz, northern Israel even formed an alliance with Syria and attacked Judah. And while this was happening, the Edomites attacked from the southeast and the Philistines hit Judah from the west. But the thing that really got me was here was Israelites attacking fellow Israelites. It was a deplorable condition that brother would fight against brother. And this is what Hezekiah was trying to heal. In fact, we're told that in 2 Chronicles 28, that in one day, 120,000 men were slaughtered of Judah and 200,000 women and children were taken captive. Hezekiah saw all that happen because it was during his father's reign. He could have very easily harbored bitterness towards his northern brethren because he witnessed all this. But here we see in this Passover arrangement that his thoughts were just the opposite. He wanted them to come back to the Lord for their own blessing and because it was the right thing to do. Jehovah deserved their worship. And of course, the lesson in all this, I think, is obvious. Do good to them that hate you, to those that despitefully use you. Pray for the blessings of your enemies. But you know, for Hezekiah, it was even closer than that because these were his brethren. They weren't just enemies. They were his brethren. And so for him to make the effort to reunite and reunify them was a real example to us. Well, the Passover instituted by Hezekiah was probably the first one that Judah had seen in a very long time. It says that 7-day celebration turned out to be such a blessing to the people that we're told that the whole assembly took counsel together and said, "Let's do this again. Let's do it for another 7 days. And then in verse 26, it says that there was great joy in Jerusalem, for since the time of Solomon, there was not the like in Jerusalem. And then verse 27 says, "Then the priests, the Levites, arose and blessed the people, and their voice was heard, and their prayer came up to his holy dwelling place, even unto heaven." You know, it had been a long time since Israel had prayed as a nation to God. And it had been even a longer time since their prayers were actually heard in heaven. The next chapter tells us that all the people who were present at Jerusalem went out to all the cities of Judah and broke down the statues and the groves that had been erected in their idolatry. And so the spirit of reformation went even to the north, to the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. It says, until they utterly destroyed all their idols. I love that. I love the work of the reformation of Hezekiah and to tear down these terrible things that were just so contradictory to the true and pure worship of our Heavenly Father. And when you look at these things, you know, you wonder, is it possible that the Lord intended this to be more than just an old, interesting Old Testament story? Could there be a picture, a kingdom picture, in some of the things that are being shown to us here? And of course, I wouldn't have asked that question if I didn't think so. I think there's a kingdom picture that the Lord is drawing for us here. I believe that in the work of Hezekiah, we're given an illustration of the ancient worthies and the work that will follow the inauguration of the new covenant. In 2 Chronicles 29:10, we read of Hezekiah's desire to make a covenant with the Lord. Remember, I think we read this. It says, "Now it is in mine heart to make a covenant with the Lord God of Israel, that his fierce wrath may turn away from us." And what he was saying really is that not make a new covenant, but renew the old law covenant that they had. It was still around, but Israel had lost sight of it. Hezekiah's desire to renew that covenant pictures the establishment of the new covenant in the kingdom, because it's through the new covenant that the wrath of God will be fully turned away from Israel and mankind. When we look at the reformation of Hezekiah, we see that there was a natural progression on how it worked. Notice that the first ones to bring their offerings to the Lord were the rulers of Jerusalem, picturing, we believe, the conversion of Israel. By reestablishing the priesthood and the temple sacrifices, Hezekiah pictures the work of the ancient worthies as they point Israel to the antitypical temple and the antitypical sacrifices. They're pointing Israel to Jesus, their Messiah, as the one who offered the true and lasting ransom sacrifice. The ancient worthies are going to teach Israel about a new mediator, and because of their acceptance of that, their prayers will once again be heard in heaven. Picture the conditions of Israel as it was described in Hezekiah's day. It says, "There was great joy in Jerusalem, for since the time of Solomon, there was not the like in Jerusalem." And I think that beautifully illustrates the joy that Israel itself will experience once they obey the voice of the ancient worthies and enter that new covenant arrangement and come to understand the need that they have for a ransom sacrifice. Now, in Hezekiah's reformation of Israel, there was a very specific connection between the reform and the Passover. And so even in that, we see that in the kingdom, before any progress can be made, either with Israel or with mankind, there will be a recognition of our Lord as the one who paid the price of redemption and deliverance. They will come to see Jesus as the true and real Passover lamb. Now, recently, I was talking to one of the brethren who's had some discussion with some Orthodox Jews. And I didn't know this, but Orthodox Jews don't believe that we need a redemptive price to be paid. They believe that when you die, that's the price. You're paying the price by dying. And that the resurrection is a result of God's grace being applied. And that sounds good. But the problem with that, of course, is that our resurrection would be taking back the penalty and thus unbalancing those scales of justice. And God's justice will not allow our resurrection without the payment of a corresponding price. So we know that a corresponding price is absolutely essential. And so I think what a blessing it's going to be for Israel when their partial blindness is lifted and when they see the lamb's blood that they smeared on the very doorposts of their heart, what it actually pictured, the doorposts of their homes, that it pictured the spilled blood of Jesus Christ, that there was a redemptive price necessary, and their own ceremonies showed it to them. Well, we know that the Passover, in general, is a picture of the gospel age. It's the firstborn that's passed over. Now, think about this. The fact that Israel celebrated a month later than the normal Passover, we believe, shows that this is a picture that follows the gospel age. As I said, it will be Israel's recognition of the antitypical lamb. One of the really wonderful desires of Hezekiah was that desire to reunite all of Israel as one family again. This may be a picture of Israel's desire to unite all fellow Jews, or it may show Israel's desire to bless the world of mankind, just as the northern tribes had gone to war against Judah and tried to destroy and actually killed many, many Jews in the time of Ahaz. So we see even a parallel between how the Gentiles have hunted and killed Jews down through the ages. And you think about that, what a remarkable thing it's going to be for Israel to want to bless the people who did that to them. As we said, the response of Hezekiah's letter and proclamations were mixed. Many came, many shared in the work and the joy of reformation, and others only mocked it. And so too, in the early stages of the kingdom, some will come and share the joys being administered from Jerusalem, and others are only going to mock it until they see greater proof coming. But the result of Hezekiah's work was that the people who did come and work for it went out and tore down all the idols and everything associated with idolatry. It's a wonderful picture of how the kingdom is going to spread. The work will begin in Jerusalem with all those able to see the vision of the kingdom and what they're being taught by the ancient worthies, and it will spread like wildfire to all corners of the world. All the modern-day forms of idolatry will be torn down one by one as the knowledge of the Lord spreads. One more arrow that is really important to me, it's going to come to America too. When Americans join with Moroccans and Libyans and French, and yes, even the Italians will find a way to get along with everyone. I just love the picture of how it's going to spread, beginning in Israel. The result of the worship in Jerusalem was that the people brought their own offerings to the temple. So many animals were brought that the priests couldn't keep up, we said earlier, and the Levites had to help. And we think that these offerings were similar to the After Atonement Day offerings that we studied in our Tabernacle Shadows. They picture, we believe, the response of the kingdom work from all over the world. The conversion of the world is not going to be one individual here, one there, like it is today. But it's going to be an overflowing response shown by the multitude of offerings brought to the temple. You know, it's interesting that Hezekiah didn't just tell the people what they had to do. He led by example. We're told that from his own herds, he offered 1,000 bullocks and 7,000 sheep. And so the ancient worthies will be examples of consecrated living, just as Hezekiah himself led the way in the Reformation of Israel. There's another interesting thing that Hezekiah did for the Israelites. We saw that when the northern Israelites came to the Passover, they had not gone through the proper cleansing rituals that they were required to do because of their recent idolatry. And so they were unclean. And their participation in the Passover was really a violation of the law. And we're told that Hezekiah prayed for them, and the Lord hearkened to Hezekiah and said it was okay. Well, you know, antitypically, brethren, I think this shows that there are going to be many in the kingdom whose heart's desire is going to be to know the Lord. And yet, they're going to be so backwards in their understanding of how to serve the Lord and how to properly approach Him, that they're going to make mistakes. But here we see a picture of the ancient worthies intervening and showing that God can even forgive those mistakes. They're going to explain the legality of their forgiveness and how the work of Jesus in the church as mediator operates during the age. Perfection will not be required, but heart intent will be looked at first. I think in this whole story, it's amazing that God would overlook such a blatant violation of the law. On other occasions, you remember how the Lord would just strike someone dead for seemingly an insignificant thing. And I think that shows that even in the law, God looked at the heart intent. And when the heart intent was right, even if they made a mistake, even in the law, there was room for forgiveness and mercy. In 2 Chronicles 31, 5 and 6, we see an amazing spirit of generosity and devotion among the people. After being instructed to bring their tithes, we're told that the children of Israel brought in abundance the first fruits of corn, wine, oil, and honey. And of all the increase of the field and the tithe of all things brought they in abundantly. They also brought in the tithe of oxen and sheep and the tithe of holy things, which were consecrated unto the Lord their God, and laid them up by heaps. In fact, there were so many tithes brought in, Hezekiah went to the priest and said, "Are you taking your share?" And they said, "We're taking everything we're supposed to be taking." But there were so many things brought in voluntarily and willingly by the people that special storage chambers had to be built just to hold them all. What a lesson this shows us of free will giving. A lesson that the whole world will learn, so much so that they will give to the Lord in abundance. And the world will finally begin learning that you receive, not by hoarding for yourself, but by giving to others. That's the spirit of the kingdom. The human spirit will become generous. You know, human spirit is already generous. You see that whenever there's a disaster that happens, that people just help each other and support each other. We have an abundant earth. Even today, our earth can feed and support every poor, hungry child that exists on the world. The problem is that there's greed involved in our world today. But you take that greed away, and mankind's wealth will be enough to make everyone who has ever lived a wealthy individual. Brethren, I can't wait. I can't wait for the time when the Lord will take first place in the hearts of men and women of this world. When the great artists, when the great musician, the great craftsman, when every person who lives on this earth will say, what can I give to the Lord for his goodness towards me? What best gift can I give to show my appreciation for the resurrection, for the blessings of life, for the goodness of the earth, for the love of the human family, and for the love of God and Jesus? It's going to be a pivotal point in human history when their continual giving to God will be so abundant. Well, let's wrap this up with 2 Chronicles 31:20 through 21. And note again, in Hezekiah's spirit, the spirit that we will see in the ancient worthies. It says, and thus Hezekiah did throughout all Judah, and he did that which was good, right, and true before the Lord his God. In every work which he began in the service of the house of God, in law and in commandment, seeking his God, he did with all his heart and prospered. That's the spirit of the consecrated. Do it with your heart, do good, do right, and be true. And if you do that, you will prosper, just as the work of the ancient worthies will prosper in the coming kingdom. Well, the next chapter takes a very interesting turn. We've come back to the story of Sennacherib, and now we see the testing of Hezekiah along very different lines. Let's read 2 Chronicles 32:1. It says, after these acts of faithfulness, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and invaded Judah and besieged the fortified cities and thought to break into them for himself. Now, when you first read that, it's a little misleading. It sounds like Sennacherib came just after these reform works of Hezekiah. Sennacherib actually came against Jerusalem in the 14th year of Hezekiah. So this was like 13 years later, after the reformation of Judah and Israel. In the following verses of chapter 32, we see Hezekiah making preparations for war. We're told that he shut up all the water supplies so the Assyrian army would not have access to them. Those of you who have been in Israel, I'm sure you've been to Hezekiah's tunnel. This was the time that Hezekiah's tunnel was constructed so that Jerusalem's water supply, which originated outside of the city, would still be able to provide water into the city. In verse 5, we're told that the walls of Jerusalem were built up and fortified, and many weapons of war were prepared. Hezekiah was also aware that the people themselves would need encouragement. The end of 2 Chronicles 32:6, it says that Hezekiah spake comfortably to them, saying, be strong and courageous, be not afraid nor dismayed of the king of Assyria, nor for all the multitude that is with him, for there be more for us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles. And the people rested themselves upon the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. You know, Hezekiah knew that fear was a very powerful weapon. He knew that fear could be paralyzing. When it paralyzes the Lord's people, the reason is usually because they're not able to see the invisible hand of the Lord working behind the scenes. All they see is the visible enemy surrounding their city. And you know, fear has been a weapon of the adversary for thousands of years. And in this story, we see it playing a prominent role. Fear and intimidation were prominent weapons used by Sennacherib. If you turn back to 2 Kings chapter 18 and 19, there's a more detailed account of the psychological battle that began before arms were even taken up. When Sennacherib's army arrived at Jerusalem, we're told that he sent out three emissaries to intimidate and to threaten Hezekiah and Judah. And as the three men approached the walls of Jerusalem, Hezekiah likewise sent three men out to meet him. This is what Rabshakeh, who was one of the Assyrian emissaries, said to Hezekiah's men. He said, now on whom dost thou trust, that thou rebellest against me? Now behold, thou trusteth upon the staff of this bruised reed, even upon Egypt, on which if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh king of Egypt unto all that trust on him. But if ye say unto me, we trust in the Lord our God, is not that he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah hath taken away, and hath said to Judah and Jerusalem, ye shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem? The Lord said unto me, go up against this land and destroy it. You see the lies that are being told there, the deceptions that are being fostered. And you know, as the three Hebrew men stood there before Rabshakeh, and as they looked out upon the ocean of Assyrian soldiers that were before them, they were intimidated. And they knew that the men on the wall behind them were afraid as well. In fact, the first thing that one of them, the Jewish men, says to Rabshakeh was, speak, I pray thee, to thy servants in the Syrian language, for we understand it, and talk not with us in the Jews' language, in the ears of the people that are on the wall. You see what he's saying there? You know, don't speak to us in Hebrew, because the men will understand you. Well, that's all that Rabshakeh needed to hear. He knew that his fear was working. So instead of changing languages and speaking in Assyrian, he shouts in Hebrew so that he made sure that all the men on the wall could hear him clearly. His words start in 2 Kings 18:28. I'd love to shout this to you like he might have, but I'm not going to do that. Just imagine the power of his voice and what he was trying to convey to the men on the wall. You can feel the power that he spoke with. He said, hath my master sent me to thy master and to thee to speak these words? Hath he not sent me to the men which sit on the wall? Then Rabshakeh stood and cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language and spake, saying, hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you out of his hand. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us, and this city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. And then he goes on in the rest of the chapter, and he tells the Jews all the things that the Assyrians had conquered, that there had been no god of any other people who was able to deliver them from the Assyrians. And so you see the overwhelming show of intimidation here. Who could deny the power of Assyria? They were mighty. They had never been defeated. They were on one of those undefeated teams, you know. There was no military conquest that they could not overcome. And so Jerusalem was like an island, like a remnant, as Hezekiah had called it. Fighting the Assyrians just did not seem to be the logical thing to do. And Hezekiah's three men, they came back to Hezekiah and they rent their clothes. They were terrified. And Hezekiah himself rents his clothes. He puts on sackcloth, which is a symbol of mourning. He went to the temple and he prayed to the Lord. He sent word to Isaiah, the prophet, who sent word back to Hezekiah that he should not be afraid of the blasphemous words of the Assyrians, that the Lord would deliver them. But the onslaught continued of intimidating words. In 2 Kings 19:10 through 13, Rabshakeh sent a letter to Hezekiah with similar boastings and fearful words. And of course, you remember this beautiful scene. Hezekiah takes the letter, takes it into the temple, and he lays it down before the Lord. Brethren, here's an honest picture that we're being conveyed. A man who dearly wanted to do the Lord's will, but he was still afraid. His flesh still quaked. So here you see a struggle between faith and human fear. I guess it's an obvious statement, but Hezekiah did the right thing. He was honest with the Lord. He told him he was afraid of this, but he went to the Lord for help and for guidance. And again, the Lord sent word through Isaiah that Hezekiah had nothing to fear, that God would deliver Jerusalem. At the end of verse 28, God said that he would put hooks in Sennacherib's nose and a bridle in his lips and lead him back to where he came from. And then the account goes on and tells us that the Lord's angel slew 185,000 Assyrian soldiers in that one night. And now you look at that, and I guess you can't say that there's joy in the death of so many men. But can you imagine the feeling in the hearts of the Hebrew men as they looked out over the walls of Jerusalem and saw what the Lord had done for them? It was a joy of deliverance. It was knowing that they would live again, they would continue to live, and that God was true to his word, that God made a promise, and he kept it. In 2 Chronicles 32:21, it says that when Sennacherib saw what had happened, he returned with shame of face to his own land. Quite a contrast to the boasting words of Reb Sheka. Also, these honest details we get from the scriptures show us the emptiness of Sennacherib's spin on history when he recorded that he had Hezekiah trapped like a caged bird in Jerusalem. The truth is that all his boasting words were empty, that they didn't mean anything, that his mighty army did not put one scratch on the walls of Jerusalem because it was God's city. And in spite of the human fear that these men had, they still had the faith to believe that God would deliver them. Brethren, faith will always be the correct response to everything that we fear in life. Any trial, any experience, no matter how overwhelming it might appear, no matter how no way out it might look, if our response is faith, it will always be correct. And we don't have to feel bad when we're afraid because we're human, we're fallen, we have these human tendencies, but we have to combat our fear with faith. And when we do that, the Lord will respond. You know, I'm looking at this story again. I have to ask the question, could this experience be symbolic of a future event? And of course, I think that it is. And there are a couple of possibilities to this siege of Jerusalem. And the first possibility is in relation to Israel's deliverance and Jacob's trouble. There are certainly similarities between what's happening here and what will happen in Jacob's trouble. We're told that in Jacob's trouble that only a remnant of Israel will be left, and they will be attacked from the north. Well, here it is. Assyria is from the north of Israel, and Hezekiah called Jerusalem a remnant of Israel. In Jacob's trouble, God says that he will fight for them as in the days of old. Well, here's one of the days of old. You know, so there seems to be a similar parallel. But there's another possibility that I think fits even better. And the reason is because of the previous picture that we saw in the reforming work of Hezekiah and how it pictured the kingdom work of the ancient worthies. Sennacherib's siege of Jerusalem happened some 13 years later, after the restitution work of Hezekiah had prospered in the land. And because of this time connection, we would say that the attack of Assyria might better picture the little season. Remember in Revelation 20, verse 8, we read that Satan shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth. That's really what Sennacherib tried to do. He tried to deceive the people into believing that Hezekiah was lying to them, that in fact the only way for them to sit under their own vine and fig tree was to make an agreement with him and offer him gifts. He said that he would lead them out of Israel into a land of milk and honey where they would live and not die. Again, more lies. And then in Revelation 20, verses 9 and 10, it says that in a little season, Satan's host compassed the camp of the saints about in the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And the devil that deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone. And so similarly, Sennacherib had encompassed Jerusalem, and in both cases we see a miraculous destruction of Jerusalem's enemies. And again, the lesson, no matter where you put the symbolism, if it's there, the lesson is that no one can stand against the Lord. No one can intimidate the Lord, and no one can do those things to anyone who truly believes in him. Following that final deliverance, we read of the rich future that lies ahead for mankind. Ephesians 2:7 says that thus he shows for all the ages to come the tremendous generosity of the grace and kindness he has expressed towards us in Jesus Christ. Isn't that one of the most loveliest verses you'd ever read? Let me read it again. Thus he shows for all the ages to come the tremendous generosity of the grace and kindness he has expressed towards us in Jesus Christ. Brethren, life is a gift from God. Deliverance is a special grace. It was for Hezekiah in ancient Israel, and it will be for all the willing and faithful of our race. Well, the story of Hezekiah doesn't end there, and that's why I asked for a little more time, because there's so many good things in this. In 2 Kings 20, we find out that while all this was happening with Sennacherib, Hezekiah was sick with a very severe boil. And in his sickness, Isaiah came to him and told him that he should get his house in order because his sickness was unto death. And Hezekiah prayed with tears to the Lord, and again his prayers was answered. In 2 Kings 20, verse 6, we're told that God assures Hezekiah that he would extend his life by 15 years. And Hezekiah asked for a sign that this would happen. And as you probably know, the sign was that the sun should go back 10 degrees. Let me read the Isaiah account. This is Isaiah 38:8. It says, "Behold, I will bring again the shadow of the degrees which has gone down in the sundial of Ahaz 10 degrees backwards. So the sun returned 10 degrees by which degrees it was gone down." Now, the skeptic would look at that. That's impossible. You can't make the sun go back 10 degrees. For the sun to go back 10 degrees, you'd have to stop the earth, spin it around the other way, and reverse it. It would violate all the laws of nature, and every living creature on the earth would be destroyed. But there's an interesting scientific explanation for this. If you get a chance to get a good encyclopedia, look up the word halo. In there, you'll find that halos are often formed around the sun by ice crystals in the atmosphere, similar to how rainbows are formed with water molecules. These crystals can actually act as prisms to refract or bend the light of the sun. Just to give you a simple explanation, because that's the only technical part I could understand, I read that there are different types of halos that can actually form simultaneously. First, there can be a circle around the sun called the inner halo. And I have to tell you, I was in Seattle about a month ago, and I saw my first halo. And maybe because I was looking for it, it's probably been there before, but it lasted for probably 2 hours. It wasn't just a brief thing, and it was just like that. It was a perfect circle around the sun. Of course, the sun didn't go back, but then again, I didn't ask for it to go back, so it just stayed there in its place. Well, then, there can also be a larger halo that circles the sun at 90 degrees from the inner halo. It's a luminous ring that follows the horizon of the earth. You can actually have a vertical and a horizontal halo at the same time. And on this horizontal halo, there can be bright colored spots that are images of the sun. And where the two halos intersect, the image of the sun can be very bright as the sun itself. Science actually calls these suns, these images, mock suns or perihelia, par meaning and helia meaning sun, additional suns in the sky. And with certain formation of ice crystals, you can actually see three equally bright suns in the sky, all appearing in a row, the real sun and the two mock suns. Now, to make the sun dial go back 10 degrees, all the Lord would have had to do was to form these halos and mock suns, and then bring a cloud cover to hide the two most advanced suns. And as the clouds moved in, the shadow of the sundial would actually go backwards. That's really what the account in 2 Kings 20, verse 11 tells us. It says that he brought the shadow 10 degrees backwards, not the sun, the shadow. Well, does that explanation, if that's the right explanation, does that minimize the miracle? Oh, not at all, not at all. Miracles are just as impressive because of their timing and their circumstances. God often uses natural means to create a miracle, but having them occur at the intended moment shows his absolute mastery and control of everything that we know. It was a sign given by the Lord to Hezekiah to prove that he would keep his promise of extending his life. And if there is a picture in that, and I'm not sure that there is, but if there is a picture in the extending of Hezekiah's life, that it might illustrate the change of nature from human to spirit beings that Brother Russell suggests for the ancient worthies. It will be like giving them a new life. Well, Hezekiah's last words are given in Isaiah 38:19. He said, "It is the living who give thanks to thee, as I do today. A father tells his son about thy faithfulness. The Lord will surely save me. So we will play my songs on the string instruments all the days of our life at the house of the Lord." Now, in these last words of Hezekiah, we're given an interesting clue that may explain something that we find in the book of Psalms. Notice that, I guess I should have done that earlier. He says, "We will play my songs." And you think, well, what songs could he be referring to? We won't take time to go into great detail. Just let me mention that in the book of Psalms, there are 15 psalms that are subtitled A Song of Degrees. I'm sure you've seen those, that subtitle in above these chapters. They consist of Psalms 120 through 134. The subtitles should actually read The Song of the Degrees, showing that the compiler had something very specific in mind. Now, you might look at this in the appendix of the Companion Bible, Appendix 67. The thought is presented that these 15 chapters of Psalms correspond to the 15 years that Hezekiah's life was extended. And it suggested that these are the chapters that Hezekiah was referring to when he said that they would sing his songs. These chapters were actually written by David and Solomon, but compiled by Hezekiah in such a way that he could use them as a memorial of the Lord's deliverance of Jerusalem and the extension of his own life. The word for degrees in the subtitles is the same Hebrew word for the 10 degrees that the shadow went back on the sundial. In these 15 chapters, there are 3 repetitive themes, and you'll see how they fit exactly what happened to Hezekiah. The 15 chapters are divided into 5 sets of 3 chapters each. The 3 themes follow each of the 3 chapter divisions. The first theme is distress from the deceit and scorn of others. The second theme is trust in the Lord, expressed by God's people. And the third theme is the blessings of peace that come to his people as a result of their trust. So we have distress, trust, and blessings and peace. That's a universal theme that all of the Lord's people go through at some time in their life or another. This was also the special experience of Hezekiah, and so these chapters had a deep personal meaning to him. Listen to what he says in one of the Psalms, and you'll see Hezekiah's own experience reflected right in it. In Psalms 124, 6 through 8, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who hath not given us as a prey to their teeth. Our soul is escaped as a bird out of the snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken and we are escaped. Our help is in the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth." Of course, this passage makes a very clear allusion to Sennacherib's contention that Hezekiah was like a caged bird. But the reality is, of what Sennacherib didn't say, is that the Lord opened the cage and released his people. And the lesson in all of this is that, as in the days of old, there is no enemy of the Lord's people that can really harm them. There is no fowler, there's no cage that can hurt them or cage them up, because our Lord is the one who made heaven and earth, and he devotes himself to his faithful people.